Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role did Dungeons & Dragons play in the formation of the vast and proud nerd subculture of the 21st century? And what is it about this complex and time-consuming game that fans find so irresistible? For nearly 40 years, D&D has united players around their rulebooks, graph paper, and 10-sided dice as they take each other on remarkable journeys of the imagination that are never the same twice. And while the open-source nature of D&D has had a powerful influence on the development of highly sophisticated video sandbox games and live-action role-playing exercises, the old-school version, played around kitchen tables, is arguably as beloved as ever. Journalist David M. Ewalt understands that. He's been playing since he was 10 years old, and today is proud to be known as both a writer for Forbes magazine and a lawful neutral 12th-level cleric and divine spellcaster. His new book is called Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons & Dragons and the People Who Play It. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
How did you find your way to D&D in the first place, and what appealed to you about the game back then?
Well, the first time I played the game, I was in fourth grade, and I was hanging out with my normal childhood friends. So I was at a friend's house for the weekend, and in between lighting off fireworks and running around in the backyard with the dog, he suggested to us, hey, do you guys want to play this cool game I found? I was a little skeptical. He wanted us to sit around a table and do some math and roll these weird dice, but the game turned out to just be completely mind-blowing. It really surprised all of us because we'd only played games that were very limited, that had very specific rules of what you can and cannot do. And Dungeons & Dragons is really about taking a flight of imagination and doing whatever you wish within this fantasy world.
So for people who maybe have heard all the jokes but have never sat down across from a dungeon master, would you give us just sort of a quick overview of what play is like?
Sure. Well, I like to describe it to people more as a form of collaborative storytelling than as a traditional board game. It's not like Monopoly, where you're going to sit down and you're going to have a board with specific spaces and a very sort of limited set of rules. What you're going to do is you're going to sit down with a group of people, maybe two or three, maybe as much as seven or eight, around a table. One person is called the Dungeon Master, and they're the person that's kind of creating the story for all of you and sort of directing you through it, like a director in a film. And gameplay is really done mostly in your heads and through speaking to each other. So the Dungeon Master might say, you're in a dark room. There's a single torch on the wall providing the only light you can see. The door on the far end is locked shut, and you can't see what's on the outside. So you might say, well, I go and try to unlock the door, or I go knock down the door. And depending on what action you tell the Dungeon Master you're going to take, he's then going to use a set of rules and dice to sort of moderate those actions. So it's not just pure make-believe. The imagination and the story you're telling is moderated by real rules and dice. That's what makes it a game as opposed to just fantasy.
It does sound like maybe there's a sort of almost like an improv yes and thing going on there, though.
There's definitely a lot of similarities to improv. The stories are at their best when the people around the table are really helping each other build it and when they're acting cooperatively. So not just in terms of dialogue, but also in terms of, well, we've got this monster we've got to fight. I'm going to let you go in and actually stab the dragon. I'm going to play a support role. I'm going to shoot arrows from behind, or I'm going to cast some spells that I know will help you. So it really becomes kind of a team exercise where it is important to sort of pass off to your partner and build on each other's strengths.
So how do you create your character, and then what impact do a character's attributes have on your experiences as a player within a game?
The character building is one of these more heavily moderated parts of the game, because you do actually have a sheet of paper and you're defining a character in terms of some very specific attributes and skills. So you roll a couple dice and that'll tell you what the strength of the character is, usually falling between 3 and 18. And that'll tell you what their intelligence is and what their dexterity is. And those are all statistics that will come up in the game. If I try to knock down a door, the Dungeon Master might ask me, well, how strong are you? You also pick skills and buy yourself equipment and stuff like that. And then you fill out sort of the backstory yourself. That's where your imagination comes back in. And you say, okay, I know now that I've got this very strong character who's very good at fighting. So I'm going to sort of create a backstory for him where he's kind of a Conan the Barbarian type of character that wanders the wilderness and you know, fights bad guys.
And I guess the moderated aspect of that is what keeps everybody in the game from being like the most all-powerful figure that can do everything with ease.
Right. If there wasn't rules and if there wasn't a referee really moderating things, it would very quickly turn to chaos. And the game actually kind of got its roots from war games. And those were situations where you had people modeling famous battles in history, and they needed a referee. They needed a person to say, oh, well, your cannons can't get up that hill. That hill is too steep. Or those infantrymen are out of range. You can't shoot them. And that referee idea carried over into Dungeons & Dragons because you really need someone to keep things from getting too crazy.
You actually tried playing some of those battlefield simulation games. And the one thing that you found frustrating was that the focus there is on being sort of historically accurate as opposed to letting your imagination take you to the very edge of possibility.
Yeah, that's right. There's still war games are still pretty popular in the United States. They were very big in the U.S. post-World War II. Part of that was just that the games had kind of come over from Europe at the beginning of the century, but it was also that a lot of veterans came back from the World Wars and found it entertaining to sort of simulate all these historical battles. But the emphasis on those games frequently does become, well, we're going to be very specific about what infantrymen can and cannot do, about what the exact range of these cannons were in the real world. And for the people who enjoy these games, a big part of the fun for them is debating the history of saying, oh, well, that would never happen. Napoleon's infantrymen never acted like that. That's not the formation they used. And so they enjoy that aspect of it. But there was some players of those games who wanted to be more imaginative and play around more with the tropes of the game. And they were the ones who said, you know what, I'm gonna stick a wizard onto this battlefield. He's going to shoot the infantrymen with a fireball, and we'll see what happens then. And so the games kind of grew out of that and became more fantastic and more adventuresome over time.
Who were some of the most influential authors in demanding, sort of creating a demand for games like D&D that had these very fantastical elements to them?
Well, when the game was published in 1974, and the two guys who were mostly credited with creating it are Gary Gygax and David Arneson. Both of them were very big fans of Robert E. Howard, who wrote all the Conan the Barbarian novels. They were heavily influenced by those. Now, around that same time in the U.S., J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings novels were very, very big. They were huge in college campuses. You know, that was a time of in U.S. history where you could go to a campus and see Frodo lives spray-painted on the side of a building. Arneson and Gygax say they were less specifically influenced by him, that they weren't as much fans of his, but it's clear that the people who were playing the game in those early stages were definitely heavily influenced by Tolkien. And you find a lot of the same fantasy archetypes that you see in Lord of the Rings show up very frequently in Dungeons & Dragons.
One thing I learned from your book is that, strictly speaking, there is nothing to require players to limit their adventures to these sort of medieval settings.
That's right. I mean, the first of these games started out in a quasi-medieval setting, you know, sort of classic. There's knights and there's heroes, and every combat is fought with swords, and people live in castles. But as the games evolved, people started to realize, well, if this is a game based on imagination, we can set these fantasies anywhere. There are games that are set in space, on spaceships or space stations. There are games that are set in sort of Cold War era spy games. The campaign that I write about in the book is a traditional D&D game in the sense that we have wizards and warriors, but our dungeon master's actually set it in the post-apocalyptic future of Earth. He's designed a scenario where society has collapsed, civilization is gone, and magic has kind of come back to the world. So we've got all the sort of familiar tropes of wizards and warriors and monsters roaming the countryside, but the countryside we're roaming is the ruins of San Francisco and Los Angeles and other cities like that.
Hmm. So how did Gygax and Arneson and the other collaborators that they would work with along the way come together and start talking about putting a game like this into place?
Well, in the 60s and 70s, there was this subculture of wargaming enthusiasts across the United States. And because it was kind of a small subculture, they had to stay in contact just to have enough people to play. So these people would, you know, they had little magazines and newsletters they shared amongst each other, and they would hold frequent conventions all over the country where, you know, maybe 30, 40 people show up, but that could be your only chance to find enough like-minded people to recreate one of these Napoleonic battles or a great sea battle or something like that. Dave Arneson, who was a college student in the Twin Cities, was one of the first people to hit on the idea of, well, what if instead of having a Napoleonic battle, what if I took all these characters, what if I had people play a single hero, and then I sent them into the dungeons beneath a medieval castle and had them explore the dungeon and fight monsters. And once he had kind of hit on that idea and saw how much the people in his game group enjoyed it, the natural conclusion he reached was, oh, I've got to share this with my fellow wargamers. I've got to share this with my friends. And he went to a convention which is now gotten huge called Gen Con, at the time was at Lake Geneva in Wisconsin. And he went there with a couple of his friends and met up with Gary Gygax, who was a very small-time game publisher, and shared the idea with him. And Arneson and Gygax, over the course of several years, developed the game together via letter and phone calls and lots and lots of testing with their friends.
And it didn't occur to them at the time that this could be like a big financial boon to anybody.
No, I don't think so. I think they clearly understood this is a new kind of game that people are very excited about. Our friends love playing this game. And I think Gygax in particular said, this is a game I can sell. People will buy this. But I don't think he ever imagined that it would be more than, you know, maybe 10,000 wargamers across the country could be his potential audience.
So they had different sort of strengths and weaknesses as partners in game design. Will you talk about that a little bit?
Well, they did. Gygax is the more famous of the two. He stayed at the company longer, and he was a very public figure. That was his real strength. He was much more of a visionary. He was the guy who saw the potential of the game, and he was a very good spokesman for it. He was very aggressive in promoting the game in the media and in game magazines, and also in chasing after people he thought were stealing from the game, were making copies from it. He very vigorously defended it. Arneson was a different character. Arneson was much more interested in playing games and coming up with cool ways to do things. He was really about, what's the mechanics of this game? How can I come up with a different way to play? How can I surprise people with what they're going to do when they sit down at this table? I like to sometimes draw a comparison between Arneson and Gygax and Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. And they're really contemporaries. And I think it was sort of a similar scene in the Twin Cities and in that part of the U.S. versus what was happening in Silicon Valley at the time. Whereas, you know, here you've got two guys where one's really the visionary. He's much more of the ruthless businessman. And the other one is the engineer. He's the guy who likes tinkering and figuring out how to make things work.
And, of course, there's always one person whose name becomes more famous than the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Gary Gygax and Steve Jobs definitely share that. And, you know, they have other similarities, too, in that, you know, they both frequently criticized for being aggressive against competitors, for maybe being too ruthless as a businessman, and also because both of them eventually got booted from their own company.
My guest is David M. Ewald. He writes for Forbes magazine, and he's the author of the new book of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons and Dragons and the People Who Play It. If you've got a question to ask or maybe want to share your experiences with the game, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Forbes magazine's David M. Ewalt. His new book is called Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons and Dragons and the People Who Play It. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, how did D&D get its name?
Well, it was one of these things where the game came along before they had a name for it. Arneson and Gygax were developing it for several years and just calling it the fantasy game. And when it came time to actually produce a product and start selling it, Gygax wrote down on a piece of paper two long columns of names, the things just basically adjectives and things that described the fantasy world that he was designing. And he handed the list to his young daughter, to Elise Gygax, and she sort of flipped through it and picked two words out that grabbed her, and they were Dungeons and Dragons. And he said, you know what, that's the name right there.
And of course, that has spawned like a million imitations since.
It was kind of funny. At the time, you know, the game was so unique, it really was not only the first game of its type to be seen, but it got so many people's attention that there was a slew of imitators right off the bat, and people called them the ampersands and alliteration games, because there was Tunnels and Trolls, there was Castles and Crusades, and there was lots of other games that tried to capitalize off of that sort of name scheme.
So for people who want to play this, there's not a large financial investment to start off with. You can get this sort of guidebook and you get some paper and you sit down. But there's a pretty significant investment of time, right, to understand how the game works and what you need to do.
Yeah, it's going to require an investment in as much as you can't just spend half an hour. At the very minimum, you're going to need a block of time. You're going to need several hours to sit down. Hopefully, you're sitting down with people who've played the game before and can sort of explain it to you and can watch what they do. But even then, because you're telling a story, it's not the kind of thing that you can tell in half an hour or 45 minutes. A game at the shortest time is going to be 2 hours. And most of these games are, we call them campaigns, where you're telling a story bit by bit, sort of chapter by chapter. So people will come and play, you know, once a week. It's kind of like having a poker night. And they'll play every single week for months or for years. Or I've met people who have played in the same campaign for decades.
So to the extent that the game is ultimately a sort of framework for collaborative storytelling, it would seem that some people might make far more satisfying contributions than others. What tells you that somebody's a good fit for a particular campaign?
Well, I think there's room in a game for every type of personality, but because it is a role-playing game, often people who have sort of that outgoing personality, people who want to sort of act, people who are willing to put on a character a little bit, those people thrive in these games. But it's important to note that you don't have to, you know, be an improv expert, or you don't even have to be an extrovert to play these games. People can be very comfortable just sort of showing up, letting other people step forward and be the star, and you can just sort of roll the dice and do a supporting role. But yeah, I find that even people who are very introverted, when they start getting involved in the games, it pulls them out of their shell a little bit, and they start to participate more in the role-playing side.
So there's a small element of memoir to this book, and you write about the fact that for a long time you had a rather complicated relationship to your love of D&D. What made you feel like you had to keep it a secret that you liked to play this game?
Well, I grew up playing the game in the 1980s, and I was lucky that my parents didn't have a problem with the game, but at the time the game had a lot of negative connotations around it, and a lot of parents didn't want their kids playing it. D&D kind of got looped in along with heavy metal and other things of the early 80s as, you know, this is a corrupter of youth. It's satanic. This is something that's bad for children. And so on one aspect, parents didn't want to see their kids doing it. Authority figures discouraged it. But then there was also the idea that D&D was just something extremely geeky. If you don't really know what it is, you assume someone who plays Dungeons & Dragons, they're playing make-believe. They're playing cowboys and Indians. And for a teenager or for an adult to be playing cowboys and Indians, you think, well, that person, that's really weird. There's something wrong with that person. So people sometimes are a little embarrassed about playing the game, and I don't think it's because there's anything wrong with the game. I think it's just because other folks don't really understand what it is that we're doing.
It was funny to me that you felt this need to sort of keep it secret, and now you don't mind. You'll let people know that you play, but you felt like you had to draw the line at what's called LARPing, which is live-action role-playing. Mm-hmm. Talk about how That trend relates back to D&D and how the enthusiasts of both are a little bit different from one another.
Well, I think that that's one of those scenarios where, like, anybody who's sort of an obsessive in their own particular area of interest, they always draw a line of, I collect Beanie Babies, but I only have 1,000 of them. I know this person. She has 10,000.
She's got a problem.
LARPing, or live-action role-playing, kind of grew out of both Dungeons & Dragons and also historical reenactments, which kind of, you know, part of that is sort of Civil War reenactments, but also people who belong to things like the Society for professional anachronism, the people who show up at, like, Ren fairs and who dress up as knights and things like that. And a LARP is where you're actually dressing up as a character, where you put on a cloak and a wizard hat and you are playing the game in real life. You're running around in the woods or you're at a house somewhere and you're really acting it out. You're never dropping your character and there's no dice. It's much more we're really play acting at this point. And even though I really got into role-playing games, I always had a prejudice, and I admit it was very hypocritical of me, but I looked at LARPing and said, like, oh, that's where I draw the line. I'm not putting on a costume. I'm not one of those crazy people. That's taking it too far. And as part of my research for this book, as I started getting back into Dungeons & Dragons and researching the history of it, I realized, all right, well, I base this opinion on nothing other than it's, you know, a comfortable way for me to sort of justify my own geekiness, that I'm not as geeky as these other people. I actually tried it. I tried a LARP in Connecticut, a weekend-long LARP, and it was a lot of fun. And it was cool, too, because there was a lot of people at that event. It was one that was specially designed for people who had never done it before. Hmm. And there were people from all walks of life, young and old, male and female, professional and not. And it was just everybody really enjoyed themselves and got a lot out of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Bob in Addison. Hello, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
I was always on the fringe in school of the D&D group. I never really participated, but I loved hearing their stories about, well, I did this and I did that. I think the best one was when they said they entered an empty room and then the door locked behind them, and all four walls became video screens showing I Love Lucy reruns. And they had to do dice rolls constantly to keep their sanity.
Hmm.
But I did have a question. When I heard about Dungeons & Dragons, I always associated it with the phrase steam tunnels, or being lost in steam tunnels. I was wondering if your guest could explain some of the history behind that association.
Thanks for your call.
Well, there was a famous case, really, when Dungeons & Dragons first entered the public imagination. The game had been out for several years and had caught on like wildfire among people who were already war gamers, but wasn't well known to the public yet. There was a young man named James Dallas Egbert, who was really a genius. He was a very smart kid who graduated early from high school, started college when he was only 16. But as often happens with young geniuses like that, he was very alienated from other kids, and he suffered a lot from depression and emotional problems. When Dallas went off to college, he started to make friends, and he actually found some companionship and friendship among other kids at the school who played Dungeons and Dragons. Unfortunately, for unrelated reasons, James got very depressed. He had a depressive episode and he disappeared. The police at the time investigated, and one of the few things they could figure out about him was, oh, he liked playing this game, Dungeons and Dragons. So they developed a theory, and their theory was that he had been playing Dungeons and Dragons in the steam tunnels beneath his college campus and had either gotten lost or hurt or attacked by another player, and they blamed the game for his disappearance. It turned out he had just been depressed, and he had run away and tried to kill himself. But for months, this became a national news story. I mean, it was all over the country. And the hook on the story wasn't, you know, young genius is depressed and has emotional problems. The story was weird game, Dungeons & Dragons, corrupts innocent youth. And even after he came back, you know, a lot of those news sources never went back and corrected the story and said, oh, Dungeons & Dragons wasn't to blame here. So that really helped cement D&D in the public imagination as something potentially dangerous.
1-800-933-5372 is our phone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go to Michael in Plano next. Hi, Michael. Michael, hi. Are you with us?
I'm sorry, I had my phone on mute.
All right, welcome.
Okay, yes. I was very interested in the program today because it reminded me of when I was young, back in the 60s, some friends of mine, we developed our own game out of games like Risk, Panzer Blitz, and and a game we used to play called Dogfight. And we took all the rules from all those games and made up our own game. And we built models and had armies and ships and airplanes. And based on all that, we made up our own game that sometimes we played for weeks at a time.
Sounds like the D&D spirit at work, David.
It does. And one of the cool things as I was looking back into the history of this game was just discovering the similarities between the games of that day and the environment that D&D grew out of. And it is very sort of Silicon Valley. You know, it was a maker ethos. It was that idea of, hey, let's take the rules of different things. Let's play with them. Let's make our own game. And then let's see what other people are doing. And we'll share our ideas with them, and we'll build something different. It was this very collaborative, very experimental period in the game world that technology caught up to later, and other industries, you know, haven't yet had a great moment of creativity and of collaboration like that. But it really made for a lot of really cool and interesting games.
Speaking of technology, what would you say is the legacy of D&D in the current generation of what are called sandbox video games, where you go on these quests, but you can sort of undertake them in any fashion you might choose?
I think D&D's influence is profound on the entire video game business. Some of the very first video games ever written were really attempts to automate the D&D experience. It was guys writing sort of text-based dungeon crawls. You walk, you turn right, you see a monster, you attack it. And D&D invented, as a game, it sort of pioneered and popularized some concepts that seem very normal to gamers today. But if you think about it, you know, before Dungeons & Dragons, there weren't games where you had a character that persists over time and levels up and becomes more powerful. You know, you would play Monopoly once, and then you would put the battleship away. You didn't become a level 2 battleship or a level 2 thimble, and then next time the game was different. But D&D sort of invented that idea of leveling up and getting more powerful. And other concepts like hit points and some of the archetypes like playing a fighter or a cleric or a wizard or a monk that are very common in these sandbox video games today really owe their entire existence to Dungeons & Dragons.
So how were the creators of the game and the people who were publishing it down the line, even after Arneson and Gygax were sort of out of the business, what did they have to do in order to keep up with new innovations that people playing the game had made and areas that they wanted to explore?
Well, you just hit on what was one of the central struggles for the publisher over the years and continues to be. Because on one hand, you know, it's 1974, we put out a set of rules. People go buy it, they can start playing the game with those rules. Well, once they've got the rules, they don't necessarily need to buy anything else from the company because they know how to play the game. They also might go and start changing the rules and making it different, adding their own stuff. In the early days of the game's history, its publisher, TSR, put a decent amount of attention into suing amateurs, into people who would create their own game supplements and then try to publish them and say, oh, this is our home rules. These are the innovations we came up for Dungeons & Dragons. TSR did its best to sort of stomp that out. Over time, it became such a problem that the company would publish a whole new set of rules. They'd basically throw it out and start over and say, okay, if you want to keep playing D&D, it's now D&D second edition. It's a new set of rules. You need to buy these. Your old rules and your old changes no longer apply. And there was an interesting phenomenon much more recently in the 1990s after the game changed control and was owned by a company called Wizards of the Coast up in Seattle. Wizards of the Coast kind of borrowed from the world of computer software and the open source Linux operating system. And they released a set of rules and told the world, these are yours. Take them out, play with them, add to them, change them. As long as you give us credit for the original rules, you can do what you wish. And you can publish whatever innovations you come up with. And by releasing it out into the world like that, I think they were really able to rescue the game from obscurity. It kind of started to disappear, but telling people, be an entrepreneur, take this and do with it as you wish, really helped keep it alive.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Keith in Dallas. Hey, Keith.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, here's my question, and you may have covered it. I've been with my radio off here, but just listening to you guys. It just occurs to me, speaking of like a poker night, has ever been a consideration for like a tournament, like a year-long group of players or just individuals from individual groups getting together for to make wagers or perhaps, you know, win money at this? Is that such a thing that's ever been considered, or is it just clearly for you win, I lose?
Well, there are I haven't heard of many sort of year-long competitions things like you're describing there, but there have been, you know, because sometimes it's hard to find other people to play with, there are conventions that happen all over the country all the time. And at a lot of those conventions, you can find competitive games where they'll sort of be designed for, all right, 20 people are going to play this game, and the last person standing, you know, if you don't get killed by the dragon, the last person playing wins a big prize. I think those types of play are less common just because D&D is, it's really more fun when it's cooperative, when it's collaborative, when you're sitting at a table with people and saying, all right, how are we going to work together to defeat this dragon, as opposed to, well, I'm going to let the dragon fry you guys, and I'm going to hide behind a rock so I can win the prize. But the competitive games definitely do happen, especially at those sort of convention situations.
David M. Ewalt is my guest this hour. He writes for Forbes magazine, and he has a new book out called Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons & Dragons and the People Who Play It. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Forbes magazine journalist David M. Ewalt. His new book is called Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons & Dragons and the People Who Play It. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. David, of course, there are women and girls who play this game, like it very much, really get into it. But is there a reason why they are vastly outnumbered by the guys?
I think there's a couple reasons. One is D&D has sort of at its heart, there's kind of a martial tone to it. Most games are about going out and killing monsters and fighting wars, and that's not traditionally something that young girls are encouraged to take part in. There's also an element of, you know, while I think D&D often gets unfairly targeted as something really geeky and something, you know, that's a bad thing to play, there are a lot of geeky people who play it because it's a very welcoming community, and it, you know, it has a lot of aspects that geeky kids really respond to, things like the math and logic and the fantasy elements. And so sometimes the games can be a little female unfriendly. You know, you have these poorly socialized teenage boys who, you know, it's not necessarily the place that a young woman wants to be spending her time.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Patrick in McKinney. Hey, Patrick.
Hello. I have a question about the early iterations of the game. So he mentioned the roots that the game has in wargaming, and at least as things are presently, wargames versus role-playing games, the mechanics are not very similar, and they're categorized not just thematically differently, but also mechanically. And I was wondering if we know what the early iterations of the game was like, and if it could provide a picture of
like how different it is than today's game.
Yeah, well, I mean, it might be the case that almost certainly it's the case that both have evolved since those early stages, war games and role-playing games. But I didn't know if it was the case that I just lost my train of thought.
That's all right. I think we can get something from your question so far. What can you tell us about that, David?
So the war games that fantasy role-playing kind of grew out of. I mean, I've referenced a few times these Napoleonic games, and people. Very popular at the time to simulate all these games from the Napoleonic Wars, where you have the Prussians versus the French, and a lot of those games are played out, you know, where here I have a table where we're going to simulate some terrain, and there'll be little cities on the map, and mostly we're just pushing little miniature figurines around the table and saying, this figurine represents 100 Napoleonic infantry, this figurine is 100 cannons. So the people who were playing those games, one of the first leaps was a former veteran named Dave Wesley was running one of those games for his friends, and he invited his friends over to play, but instead of doing a normal Napoleonic battle, he told them, you're a general, you're the mayor of this town, you're the banker in the town. And so he gave them people to play instead of an imaginary sort of all-powerful general who ran the entire army. The actual first D&D games, like the first versions of that fantasy game, came from something called Chainmail, which was a set of rules for running war games with medieval figures. So instead of having Napoleonic games, you had knights and their serfs and things like that fighting battles with swords and spears. Dave Arneson took those Chainmail rules and turned those into, all right, well, what if these knights, instead of there being a whole legion of them, there was just one guy? So day-to-day, the rules are very different. If you picked up a rule book for a modern war game and a rule book for modern Dungeons & Dragons, you'd see very little in common between them. But they did grow directly out of those war game rules.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. George is on the line now in Fort Worth. Hello, George.
Hi. Thank you, David, for spending the time and resources on putting together on this topic. It's near and dear to my heart. So, and I have to say, my buck a day donation to KERA is it's always great to hear stories like this. It's just the cherry on top to all the other great media that comes out from you guys. So,
well,
so thank you, Chris. So I just want to share, you know, my experience. I play with a group of six or seven different guys, and we do occasionally have our lady friends that join us from time to time, but we've been playing together since about 2005. And, you know, your comment earlier about, you know, the stigma attached to players years ago, you know, I just appreciate the diversity in our own group where, you know, we're not playing in our mother's basement. You know, we're all working professionals, parents of children and, you know, contributors to society. So, and we've been playing since about 2005, and I was just lucky enough to join into a group that had been playing since first came out. So, you know, I was able to learn the game from people much more seasoned than myself. And, you know, our campaigns last anywhere from about 5 to 10 months. And, you know, I don't know, David, if you find it this way, but our very first session of any new campaign, I liken it a lot to your draft day on fantasy football. While I hear the similarities from people that don't know think that fantasy football is basically just D&D for football geeks.
Mm-hmm.
I completely disagree with that, but nonetheless, you know, that first day of writing up your new character that you're going to be spending time with for the next year is always something that we treat quite special. So, and to the point about video games, you know, one of the things that really kind of drove me away from multiplayer video games was when they started to become connected to the internet. When we were forced to play with four players at one TV in the same room, that's a completely different dynamic than when you're behind your own TV screen playing with people, you know, worlds across from each other. And, you know, the similarities that are in the same place when you're playing around a table, you know, that's one of the things that really draws me to that.
Well, those are lots of really interesting points, George. Do you want to comment on any of that, David?
Well, yeah, I agree with George completely about the excitement of putting together a new campaign. And it's interesting to hear him say how he just started playing again in 2005. The guys that I'm playing with now that I write about in the book, we were all people who had played the game when we were kids and now are adults. And we're all married. We all have good jobs. And we kind of look back on those days and said, man, we all, you know, I want to play D&D again. I'd like to do this again. So I found these guys on Craigslist, and they're all, you know, normal professionals who see this as, you know, it's a fun pastime. It's something we like to do once a week. And these folks who I didn't know before we started playing, they're all very close friends now, you know, and the game helped us build that phenomenon of sitting around a table with people and sharing that story together. It's much more socially beneficial than a lot of these video games where, you know, there are benefits to playing a video game and connecting with people around the world. You know, people play World of Warcraft and things like that. They do make real friends. But it's a different experience to actually sit down at a table every week with five or six people, and you really grow a special bond with them.
Well, there is something interesting about that culture, and George sort of touched on this by saying that he was introduced to the game by people with more experience than he had. It seems that everyone who gets into it was introduced by someone and sort of helped along the way. It seems rare that, you know, three kids get the book and sit down together and learn all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. It is definitely. It's much harder to get into if you're sort of starting from zero on your own, because it does require some mental leaps. Dungeons & Dragons is less of an alien thing now because so many people play video games. Really, everybody plays video games at this point, even if it's just I occasionally, you know, mess around and play Angry Birds on my phone. Nearly everyone plays them. So it's a little easier to understand, but still, you know, people have a hard time sort of making that mental leap of, oh, wait, you mean I can do anything in this game? If I say I want to attack the monster, I can attack the monster. But I can also say I want to run away. Or I can also say, I'm going to beg for mercy, or I'm just going to curl up in a ball and cry. And it helps to see other people who have played the game and to watch by example and learn, like, oh, wow, there really is freedom involved here. That's different than anything I've ever done before.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Nico in Denton. Hey, Nico.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Great to be on the show. Well, I was just going to say, I actually play a spinoff of D&D called Pathfinder. By this company called Paizo, and it's basically based off of the 3.5 edition, which a lot of my friends have kind of said that the hardcore D&D players play still. Of course, there's 4th edition, and what I really wanted to ask was, most of my friends, the general consensus is that 4th edition is kind of like sacrilege to, I guess, traditional values in D&D, and I was just kind of wondering maybe where the animosity kind of sprouts from.
What do you know about that, David?
So the edition rules are the edition wars are a very controversial topic in D&D fandom and role-playing game fandom. This happens because of the issue I was talking about earlier, because the publisher has to periodically just re-release a new set of the rules, change things up in order to get people to buy a new set of product. And what happens is sometimes they change the rules in a way that the fan base doesn't respond to. What happened more than 10 years ago now was the Wizards of the Coast, which was the publisher at the time, was looking at sort of the phenomenon of gaming in the world at large, and they saw, well, what's really popular now are things like World of Warcraft, or video games. When people play fantasy, they don't want complicated rules, and they don't want, you know, the stuff that exists in Dungeons & Dragons. They want to press a button, and that's going to kill a monster. They want the sort of video gamey power. So they developed the 4th edition rules of Dungeons & Dragons, which were much more video gamey. It took away sort of the complex lists of these are the spells I can cast and these are the skills I have, and replaced them with powers, which were very much just like, I'm going to keep pressing this button, I'm going to keep doing this thing over and over again. Some people really responded to that and thought that it was a great way to learn the game. A lot of first-time players started with 4.0 because it was more familiar to them. But the folks who have been playing for a long time, a lot of them just found this to be heresy. They thought that the rules had been dumbed down. They thought that the publisher was catering to kids and to the least common denominator. And a lot of people never made the transition from 3rd edition and 3.5 to the 4th edition rules. That's actually where the Pathfinder thing that the caller was talking about happened, is that other companies spun that off and said, you know what, if the publisher of Dungeons & Dragons is going to make a game that doesn't look like Dungeons & Dragons, well, we're going to make something that does.
So it's like Coke and New Coke, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a very, that's a good comparison. It was kind of like for a while there, they said, you know what, no more Coke for you. You get this really sweet new stuff.
What's it like to go to one of these conventions?
They're really interesting. I mean, on one hand, the stereotypes and sort of the things that you would imagine are often true. I mean, they are full of a lot of, you know, people who are sometimes wearing costumes. You know, it's kind of a crazy, a crazy atmosphere. But the people who go to these conventions are just, I mean, they're some of the best people. And it's because they feel at home. You know, a lot of these people are kind of geeky. They sometimes feel like, well, nobody I know shares my interests. I'm kind of an outcast in my universe. And I don't have a lot of people to talk to about fantasy and about gaming. And they get to these conventions, and they're just so happy to be there. They're super welcoming. They're glad to sit down with you and teach you the rules to the game if you've never tried it. You know, these, some of these people, they, you know, that's the highlight of their week. If they get to draw someone else into the fold and show them how to play, they really get into that. And I've seen lots of people who show up at a convention for the first time who've never even, you know, picked up a die, who've never played a role-playing game, and they leave the convention after a couple hours completely converted. Oh, I've got to go home. I've got to find some people to do this with every week.
You still have the cape that you bought for your LARPing weekend?
I do. I have it. It's vacuum-packed under my bed. I had to buy a costume for that because in live-action role-playing, you need to dress up like a character. And I was secretly thrilled of, oh, man, I get to buy, like, a wizard cloak. But unfortunately, I don't get a lot of opportunities to wear a wizard cloak in New York City. Not yet, but I've got it there, so maybe someday.
Although, if there's any place in the world you could walk down the street in a wizard cloak and not turn heads, maybe
it's
it would
true.
Be
true. I could
soon.
Probably wear that on the subway, and I don't think anyone would say anything, at least.
Have you heard from people who sort of didn't know that this was a big part of your life since you've written the book?
I have. You know, people both who I was in high school with, you know, part of my story when I was in high school is this, you know, I did it almost every weekend with my friends. And I've talked to people who I grew up with who were like, I didn't know that's what you were doing on the weekends. I also played soccer and things like that. And they said, you know, I thought you did these other things. I didn't realize how into D&D you were. And, you know, as I've gotten back into the game in the last few years and started writing about it, there's also been people very surprised, like, oh, really? This whole time I've known you, where I thought you were a reporter and you were doing all this stuff and you were a writer, I didn't realize you were playing D&D. Like, that doesn't fit in with my mental picture of you. You're a normal person, and now I learned that you do this weird thing. Well, I guess maybe that weird thing isn't that weird.
They're not mutually exclusive.
No, they're not.
Journalist David M. Ewald writes for Forbes magazine. His new book is called Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons and Dragons and the People Who Play It. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, download the podcast, and find out about upcoming programs all at kera.org/think. If you'd like to send along a comment, question, or suggestion, you can email it to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.